The SVLPA are proud to be able to bring you this audio recording of Tom Glassy's book, Who's Afraid of the Dark? This has been made possible by the kind permission of the RNIB to use their Daisy recording of the book. This is read to you by Gordon DeLue. Please contact us at podcast@svlpa.co.uk, or you can listen to the other podcasts at svlpa.co.uk on the web. So, hope you enjoy.
Who's Afraid of the Dark by Tom Glassy. This book is produced by RNIB.
RNIB, supporting blind and partially sighted people.
Chapter 11. Every minute at home was precious. I did not want to lose a single second of the time spent away from school. While on holiday, I still had to get in a couple of night shifts at the gasworks, but by now Dad had taken to milking Alfie Cannow's cows in the mornings after he had finished work. Alfie had a small farm just outside Castletown at Red Gap. Of course, this would have to be added to my list of activities. Alfie looked on Dad's milking as a sort of neighbourly favour, but he always paid me half a crown for my part in the venture. With my night stoking completed and the cows milked at Red Gap, it was time to ride my bike home, on the road with Dad trying desperately to keep up with me and maintain control of the bike. We would have to stop off in Castletown at Peggy Watterson's toy shop, as the half-crown, about 12 pence in today's money, would be burning a hole in my pocket. As Peggy rummaged through boxes and boxes for a toy boat, I once recall her saying to Dad in her broad Manx accent, "My God, Dennis, young Thomas is black as a rook, and you'd swear been done a chef down at the gasworks with you." "He has," said Dad. However, I doubt if she actually believed him. From time to time, the Manx Blind Welfare Society would send their welfare officer out to visit us. These visits were to keep a check on my rehabilitation as a blind child and to find out how Mother and Dad were coping. We had no phone in those days, so in the main these visits would be unannounced. My mother recalls this incident. "So where is young Thomas?" inquired Mrs. Jones, the blind welfare officer. "He's upstairs in bed," said my mother. "Well, what's he doing in bed in the middle of the day at a time when he should be out playing with other children?" Mrs. Jones, I guess, was now thinking I'd been shoved off to bed out of the way, and was obviously rather taken aback by her discovery. "He's in bed because he's been stoking with his dad at the gasworks all night, and from there he went milking cows." Mrs. Jones left, saying she would return at a later date. She may well have done, and if she did, I was probably assisting Dad on a coal boat or something. One way or another, I'm sure she went away convinced that my rehabilitation was clearly heading in several directions she hadn't bargained for. Dad was one of the few people who very rarely said no to me as a child. He needed no expert training in how to look after a disabled child. The disabilities simply melted away in his presence. "Yes, you can ride a bike, you can stoke, you can milk a cow, you can do everything I do with me." And who was going to argue? By now, I had acquired a bike of my own from somewhere and was riding solo up and down the pavement outside our house at Janet's Corner. I had worked out how many pedals it took to get from the main road at the entrance of the estate to where the pavement ended at the back of the first row of houses. I would brake usually just in time to prevent myself from flying off the end of the pavement, across the road and over the garden wall of the house opposite. During my school holidays, the residents of Janet's Corner walked around the estate at great personal risk to themselves. At any time a blind child could come hurtling around the corner on a bike with no warning bell and without so much as an apology for whistling past them with less than an inch to spare. I didn't work every shift at the gas works with Dad, as it was only the night ones that really interested me. There was always something magical about the night period. There was never anyone else about for a start, which always made it a bit special. I suppose being at the gas works on the night shift was a bit like being on the steam packet boat when there were no passengers on board. You felt sort of privileged. When Dad was on day shifts and there was no one available to look after me at home, I would accompany my mother to her place of work. Mother worked as a cleaner at King William's College. The college was and still is a minor public school situated on the outskirts of Castletown. I always got a buzz walking through the college grounds on my way to work with Mother. Well, I guess I would, as I was entering a boarding school, and all these kids were stuck here, and unlike them, tonight I would be going home for my tea. I thought they would envy me, but I doubt it. I guess the main difference between my school situation and theirs was that they were all there because either they or their parents wanted them to be. Not like me, stuck in a faraway school simply because there was nowhere else to go. Unlike the gasworks, cleaning King Bill's did not really appeal to me, so I sought my own entertainment. This usually took the form of pretending the whole college was a ship. On one of these fantasies, I found myself playing in one of the numerous rooms while Mother was cleaning elsewhere in the building. Whilst carrying out a survey of the room, I stumbled across a polisher. This was similar to a vacuum cleaner, only instead of sucking, it polished. It had two brushes underneath that spun round when it was switched on. This made it an ideal imaginary outboard engine, so with my polisher plugged in and switched on, I started my engine. I discovered that by lifting the brushes off the floor and turning the polisher on its side, the revs would increase dramatically. This meant I was now clear of the harbour, and I opened up my outboard engine to the full amount. I was now at sea in my small boat and as happy as a sandpiper, until, that is, my polisher suddenly died, and I was stranded at sea with a broken engine. The inquiry, which included my mother, took place around me. They were not too chuffed about having a burnt-out polisher, but there was not a mention of my fate, stuck 7 miles off Langness Point with a broken outboard engine. When I wasn't at the gasworks or on a coal boat or with Mother at King Bill's, I could be found playing football with my Janet's Corner mates. Our home ground was a bit of a wasteland just across the road from our house. I was the goalkeeper, as that was deemed by my teammates to be the most suitable position for me. I guess their thinking went something along the lines that if you were blind, then you should be allowed to use your hands. This wasn't much of a concession, really, as all goalkeepers can use their hands. However, it was one I accepted gratefully. Matches were placed inside the ball so that I could follow it by the sound. Only one ball actually exploded. Later, we substituted the matches with tiny ball bearings. We often made the claim that our defence was the best on the island, but then any defence playing in front of a blind goalkeeper would soon learn that mistakes could prove expensive. We couldn't really lose, as when we won, we were brilliant, and with a blind goalkeeper. When we lost, it was a case of, well, what do you expect with a blind goalkeeper? On Saturday afternoons, we would head for Castletown Stadium, the home of Castletown Football Club. I would sit in the tiny stand along with my 40 or 50 commentators, which was about the average attendance in those days, unless we were playing a real crunch match against Peel or the local derby against Russian United. One of our supporters, who never missed a game, was and still is Mr. Juan Kermode, better known as Hickey. We could hear his voice booming out from the stadium long before he reached the ground. To this day, some 40 years on, Hickey is still there cheering the team on. Even though I no longer attend the matches, as I walk my dog around Poulsen Park on a Saturday afternoon, I can still hear Hickey's voice now with his famous and familiar phrase, "Come on, the town!" At that time, a local newspaper, The Green Final, containing all the football scores, came out at about 6 o'clock on a Saturday. When I went back to school, my younger brother Kevin would send me this newspaper so that I could keep in touch with my team. Many a time my Green Final was found blowing around the school playground along with the Liverpool Echo, ensuring that names such as Sid Butler, Dennis Moore and Joe Ennett, all of whom played for Castletown at that time, were mentioned by teachers and staff in the same breath as the great Liverpool and Everton players such as Ray Wilson, Alan Ball, Chris Lawler and so on. It wasn't just the football that kept me busy during the school holidays. There was also the fishing. We fished from the rocks, or occasionally from a boat if we were lucky enough to meet up with someone who was going to sea at the same time as we were mucking about around the harbour area. Most of the time, we fished with hand lines from the swing bridge that spans the lower part of Castletown Harbour. Castletown has a tidal harbour that completely dries out at low water. I recall one occasion when I had nagged my mates so much about going fishing when they obviously didn't want to, that in order to shut me up, they set me up with my hand line on the swing bridge. With my hook baited and my mates promising that they would be back for me later, I happily spent the next couple of hours waiting for a fish to bite. As far as I'm aware, I am still the only angler who has spent an afternoon fishing in Castletown Harbour with the tide completely out. Most of my relations lived in Ballasalla, and often my younger brother Kevin and I would trudge the 2 mile stretch along the banks of the Silverburn River from Castletown to Ballasalla. I loved the walk along the Silverburn. As a child, I could roam freely without the fear of bumping into objects. The grassy banks of the river and the fields that sprawled out between Castletown and Ballasalla meant that I had a fitted carpet to land on with every trip along the way. At the age of 12, I could recognise the sound of the raven and the pheasant. These were sounds I did not hear in Liverpool, and they gave the place that little extra touch of magic that no country walk could conjure up at school. A waterfall marks the halfway point of the walk. I would pick up the sound of the rushing water several hundred yards before we drew level with it. As we reached it, its volume turned to maximum, and I could sense the sheer power of the water. Then, as we passed it by, the noise of the falling water faded away behind us, and the river soon regained its more placid nature. The next landmark was the rickety old wooden bridge. Once we had crossed this, we were in prime mushroom country, and if it was early in the morning, we could deviate to pick mushrooms. Mushrooms provided a good source of pocket money, and even though I couldn't see where they were, just being part of the act made me a member of the team, and carrying the bags entitled me to my share of the spoils. Not that anyone would have argued anyway. If they had caught fish and I hadn't, I still got my share. If we went out on Langness golf links looking for lost golf balls that we could sell on, I got my share. And so it was with the mushrooms as well. I took part in all these activities with the kids who lived on Janet's Corner, and even though they were often carrying a passenger in me, they treated me exactly as one of them. No wonder I missed home so much when I was at school. I didn't really hate St. Vincent's or Liverpool. I simply loved home and the folks that made home so special. With the mushroom picking complete, it would be onwards towards Ballasalla. Apart from our own voices, the only sounds were the gently flowing river as it danced its way over the stones on its journey to Castletown Harbour. The wild birds, freely going about their business totally undisturbed by man or beast. And the sound of the occasional steam train as it puffed and clanked its way to Castletown. Upon reaching Ballasalla, my brother Kevin and I would branch off to go and visit my granddad and granny who lived in the village. Our mates would go and do their own thing, and we would arrange to meet them later to begin the homeward journey. I always enjoyed visiting Granny and Grandad's place. He was forever chewing rubber and always had as much time as I needed, no matter what he was doing when my unannounced visit occurred. Granny always had interesting things to eat, and for some strange reason a biscuit or a cake in someone else's house always tasted better than it did in your own. I don't know why, but every time I called at Granny's, she seemed to be just about to get the Hoover out. Grandad hated the Hoover, and as soon as he saw it coming, he would leg it out through the kitchen door, scooping me up with him. Once outside, we would sit on the grid in the garden, Grandad chewing on his rubber, whilst I updated him with my latest plans to escape from St. Vincent's. I always left there with my spirits lifted, as he would tell me that he was going to go and see someone in the government and talk to him or her about my plight. Well, I don't know if he ever did, but at least I felt better for knowing that my grandad was on my side. returning to school never got any easier. As I grew older, I understood it more and the reasons why it had to be this way, but right up to the age of 16, I would start feeling miserable about 3 days before I was due to go back. I can never remember a going-back-to-school day on which I didn't shed a tear, although, as I grew older, the tears and the grief became a more private matter. If there was a coal boat in Castletown on such days, Dad's two brothers, Uncle Lenny and Uncle Willie, would be at our house early for a 7 o'clock start, so the house would be full of activity from early morning. Mother would be busy making tea for Dad and his coal boat gang, whilst at the same time frantically running around, pushing last-minute things into a suitcase for me. Before leaving to discharge the coal boat, both Uncle Lenny and Uncle Willie would rummage through their pockets and hand over their loose change to me. I remember on one of these occasions, Dad had left home at about 6 a.m. to take the ropes off an incoming coal boat. Uncle Lenny and Uncle Willie both arrived at our house at about 6:30 for a mug of tea and to meet up with Dad, who was supposed to be coming back to the house for his breakfast before starting work on the boat. As my uncle sat in the house, they joked that they had seen Dad swimming like the clappers in the harbour, implying that he'd fallen in. I refused point-blank to leave home unless he returned so that I could see that he was okay. As the time for the bus taking us to the early morning boat drew nearer, Mother tried frantically to convince me that Dad was fine. I would have none of it, but with about 2 minutes to go, Dad turned up for his breakfast. I think in all my years of going back to school, that was the only occasion on which I remember returning to school relatively happy. Uncle Willie was always happy, always singing, always telling jokes. Once both uncles had handed over to me their dinner money for that day, all 5 shillings of it, they would depart with that all-too-familiar sentence, one which I'd heard over 1,000 times. "You'll be home again in 3 months. It'll soon pass." If there was no coal boat in Castletown and Dad had managed to get someone else to work his shift at the gasworks, he would take me back. This would be a slightly more laid-back affair. There would be no driving back to the house from the bus stop to collect something he had forgotten. No last-minute panic with regard to lost boat tickets. I never wanted my two brothers to come out to the bus stop with me. I hated goodbye, since they only brought on the tears. So the fewer folks to say goodbye to, the better. I wanted to share with my brothers some of my untold wealth, which was often in excess of 10 shillings, more money than they had ever had between the pair of them, but they always declined. Dad would never be still. On rough crossings he would juggle with cups of tea for both me, himself, and any other passengers who weren't able to trust themselves to make it up the stairs to the buffet bar and back without spilling the lot. There would be a trip up on deck, which lasted until I could not stand the wind any longer. Once it got to 12 o'clock, we would be nearing the Mersey Bar, and the lack of vibration through the passenger lounge floor would tell me we were now much closer to Liverpool than to Douglas. Arriving back at school was not the ordeal that it once was. I knew now where I was going. I knew which corridors to go down, and I knew the staff. Also, I had mates there now as well, and although the relationship with my schoolmates was not the same kind of relationship I had with my pals back in Castletown, nonetheless, a bonding had taken place. However, there was still the homesickness problem that never went away, and although I no longer had any fear of being far away in a strange place, and I could look after myself, I still missed home desperately. It always took me several days to readjust to the way of school life. Although, to all intents and purposes, this was a special school for the blind, the truth was that there were very few actually blind kids in the school. Most of the pupils were partially sighted, and it was these kids with whom I had bonded, rather than the totally blind kids. I guess the sighted kids were more similar to my mates at home. They were just that bit more active than the others. The majority of the blind kids seemed to be happy to spend most of their free time sitting on the school benches listening to the radio. I really don't know whether this listening to the radio had anything to do with being blind. In all schools there are kids who are more active than others, and maybe this was just a case in point. Generally, the activities that took place at school were of a much more gentle nature than those I indulged in at home. There was certainly no rock climbing, no fishing, no beach to mess about on, and almost all my free time would be confined to the school grounds. However, there was football. Chapter 12. The football at St. Vincent's was not played in the same competitive way as it was on the waste ground at Janet's Corner, but that could hardly be expected. A blind teacher, Mr. Frank McFarlane, nearly always attended our kick-around at St. Vincent's. At the far end of the playground, a large wooden board about the size of a goal mouth had been erected. This meant that the ball could not be lost in a net, and when the ball had been banged past the goalkeeper, the sound of it hitting the wooden board would tell the goal scorer that he had scored. Ball bearings were placed inside the ball, just as was done at home. Once again, I always seemed to be the goalkeeper, and I remember furious arguments taking place between me and Mr. McFarlane as to whether it was a goal or not. On hearing his shot hit the wooden goal structure, or what he deemed to be the wooden goal structure, he would immediately award himself a goal. Sometimes his shot had hit me, and sometimes I'd even saved the ball. There's nothing worse than when you've just made a blinding save than to have it denied to you by the teacher, especially when your fingers or face are still stinging from the save. Our conversation would go something like this. McFarlane, goal! Me, no, sir! McFarlane, yes, it was, Glassie. Me, no, it wasn't, sir. It hit me on the head. McFarlane, well, I could tell by the sound of it that it hit wood, so the goal stands. Mind you, I guess on balance things evened out, as there were many an occasion when the ball did go past me and struck the wooden board, and I argued that it hadn't, and that I had made yet another of my blinding saves. As Mr. McFarlane pointed out to me on more than one occasion, if I had made as many saves as I made out, I would have played for Liverpool, blind or not. Another football-related activity was the game of crab football. This was something that was pursued during school time rather than in the playground. The game had more or less the same rules as football, only you played the game in a gym. You moved about the pitch in crab form, hands behind your back on the floor. The ball was two wicker baskets about the size of waste paper baskets. Inside the baskets were placed some small tin lids for sound effects. The two baskets were then bound together in canvas, and this was our crab football. We mostly played this strange form of football amongst ourselves during PE lessons, but sooner or later someone got the idea that it would be good for us to play another sighted school. We had already played the blind school in Manchester once a year. The first match was to be against a grammar school and would be played over two legs, the first in their gym. Of course, they had never played this game before, but even so they really did not expect any serious opposition from the blind school down the road. We had to bring our own ball, as of course they did not have anything remotely like a crab football. I think they went into a fair state of shock when they got their first glimpse of this ruddy great thing they were expected to kick around their gym in their pumps. There were six players in a crab football team, and I was absolutely thrilled to be in our school team. The fact that they were a sighted school held no fears at all for me, as they were only the same kind of kids I knocked about with at home. Although we were referred to as the blind school, in fact the only blind kid in our team was me. Our striker was one of my best mates, not only at school, but anywhere. His name was Charlie, and he came from the northeast of London. Later, he made the odd trip home with me at half-term to the Isle of Man. Charlie had a fair amount of sight and was as athletic as any other kid from any other school. The poor grammar school got the shock of their lives as, straight from the kick-off, me and my mate went in wild pursuit of those tin lids and fought for possession of them like lions. I'm sure that their goalkeeper dived out of the way of the first shot at his goal as these bloody great baskets came hurtling towards him. We soon went 2-0 up, with both goals coming from Charlie. I think the grammar school was nervous about hitting such a beast of a ball. They would certainly never have seen anything like it before or since, I shouldn't think, and I'm sure they would have suffered severe embarrassment the next day in front of their chums for being defeated by the blind school. I did speak with their goalkeeper afterwards, and he expressed his surprise that they had only lost 2-0, as he had spent the whole match trying to get out of the way of the ball. We continued playing other schools at this crazy game, but the schools of Liverpool never really got hooked on it. Hence, we only ever lost one match. It wasn't just my dedication to the school crab football team that was being observed at this time. The nuns had duly noted my seemingly renewed devotion towards the church with regard to mass attendance. I was always an early riser. Even as a small child, I never had any difficulty with getting up in the mornings. Sister Sissy would call us at 7:30, allowing half an hour to dress and wash before an 8 a.m. breakfast. I would often lie awake for over an hour before this time, but the only way I would be permitted to rise earlier than anyone else would be if I was to attend the 7 a.m. Mass. Mass was said every day of the week at 7 a.m. Monday to Saturday, and at 8 a.m. on Sundays. The only Mass that was compulsory for us kids to attend was the 8 a.m. Mass on Sundays, and so it was that I decided to rise early at around 6 a.m. and attend Mass. The Mass itself was boring, but not as boring as lying in bed, and so I rose with a lark every day and took my pew in the back of the little school chapel. This devotion of mine was wrongly but understandably interpreted by the nuns as a clear indication of my faith, and possibly that the message was starting finally to get through to me. Sisters I didn't even know very well were now stopping me in the school corridors as I went about my daily business and engaging me in conversation. My pal Andy, who had accompanied me on these early morning jaunts, was experiencing the same treatment. Neither Andy nor myself were regarded as being devout churchgoers by the rest of our school pals. What the nuns and our school pals didn't realise was that Andy and I both regarded going to early morning Mass as a price worth paying. It presented us with opportunities that would not have come our way had we stayed in bed until the normal getting-up time. At 6 a.m, while all the other kids lay in their beds, the long corridors of the convent would be deserted. The playrooms and restrooms would be unsupervised, leaving the way clear for Andy and me to rummage through cupboards. We'd find cakes and biscuits and so on placed there by staff for some future use. There were also plenty of little hideaways in the playgrounds and a playing field in which to go and have a crafty smoke in practically total safety. We had about half an hour before and after Mass to indulge in these activities. The going to Mass was essential, as no one was allowed to rise before Sister Sissy appeared in the dormitory at 7:30. We had to inform Sister Sissy the night before that we were attending Mass the following morning. This way she could keep a check to see if anyone had left their bed without authorization. Andy and I were more than happy to attend Mass every morning in return for a feed of cakes and biscuits and a crafty fag both before and after Mass. Of course, our devotion did not go unnoticed by the powers that be, and in due course the Mother Superior, Sister Claire, sent for us both. It was not unusual for me or for Andy to be sent for by the Mother Superior or by the head teacher, and as we both made our way along the corridor to Sister Claire's office, we pondered as to what we might have done. Maybe we'd been seen smoking, or maybe the missing cakes had been traced to the two everyday mass-going boys. We both stood in Sister Claire's office, waiting for the lecture and the punishment we meted out. "It has been noted," she began, "that the pair of you have not missed a Mass for several months, and in recognition of this it has been decided that both of you are to become altar boys." She went on to explain to us about what an honour it was to be made altar boys. Indeed, it was one of the most sought-after privileges in the school. As we both stepped out into the corridor from Sister Claire's office, we could not believe what had just happened to us. Neither I nor Andy had bargained for being made altar boys. Neither of us was hooked on religion, and we both stood at the back of the school chapel every morning, bored sick and not taking part in the service. I did feel a few pangs of guilt, for as a result of our cake and biscuit nicking and a few crafty fags, we had now been rewarded with this prestigious honour. Also, our early morning treat of cakes and biscuits would now be turned into something of a feast, as from now on we would have access to wine as well. Smoking, feasting and boozing at 6 a.m. in the morning and in a convent school, who would have believed it? This kind of thing wouldn't even happen at home, and I don't think any of my mates at home would have believed me if I'd told them that before school most mornings we spent our time feasting on cakes, smoking fags, and knocking back a glass of wine or two. As altar boys, we had to be in the chapel before anyone else in order to get everything ready for the priest to say Mass. Andy and I would help ourselves to a glass of wine. I think we thought it helped us to get into the spirit of things. Most of the time, we would only have one glass, but occasionally we might have two, and on one occasion we had a real binge. Indeed, I think it was that binge that finally led to our relatively short careers at the altar. I don't think either Andy or I looked on it as an honour to serve at the altar. It simply meant that the Mass was not so boring as when we were sitting on one of the pews. We certainly did not see it as taking our first steps towards priesthood. I think our dismissal had been on the cards for quite a while, even before Andy puked up one day on the altar during the Mass because of a slightly heavier drinking bout before Mass in the sacristy. I do not remember any great fuss being made of us being fired. We simply were not selected any more. There was no big announcement or anything like that. As far as I know, we were only boys who used to be altar boys. In most cases, when lads became altar boys, they remained so until the end of their school days. I never did like wine, and still don't to this day. It was simply a case of don't eat the forbidden fruit. At the time of our binges, the wine had not been consecrated, which must have meant, at worst, that we were only guilty of underage drinking, and not the more serious sin of abusing the Lord's blood. However, I do recall relating to someone at one time how Andy and I were, in fact, holier than the priest himself, as we had a great deal more of the Lord's blood in us than he had. During the service, he would only take a small sip, as opposed to our several glasses downed in the sacristy before the start of Mass. Chapter 13. The half-term breaks were now beginning to take a different twist. My mother's three brothers, Louis, Sean and Tommy, had all left Ireland and set themselves up in London. Uncle Louis, who had left Tipperary with little more than his fare to London, had now worked his way up and owned a building firm that employed over 600 men. My Uncle Tommy was working as a site manager for him, and Uncle Sean, who had gone to London as a coach driver, had bought his own coach. At half-term, Mother and sometimes Father would come over from the island, and we would all make our way down to London. Uncle Tommy didn't drive, so it was always Louis or Sean who would drive up to the school, having first picked up Mother or Father or both from the boat. When Uncle Louis came, it was always in style, the Jag or the Merc. Of course, we were not accustomed to being driven about in such luxurious modes of transport. I'm not sure what the nuns made of it all. From their point of view, last term I had to stay at school because we couldn't afford the boat fare home. This term I was setting off to London in a Jag or a Merc, and seemingly money was no object. Speeding down the motorway to London from Liverpool was not quite the same as crossing the Irish Sea by boat, and it certainly wasn't the same as going home. But it wasn't a bad second best. We usually stayed in Louis's house with his wife Joan and their five kids. It was a huge house with more than one bathroom. I'd never known a house to have more than one bathroom. There was also a phone. I had never stayed in a house with its own phone before. The phone never stopped ringing. Men querying their wages, site managers looking for Louis, and contractors from building sites all over London looking for Louis. He was indeed one of the biggest building contractors in London, and the phone would keep ringing until well after midnight with his unwearying wife Joan never tiring of answering it. Several years earlier, Louis had simply got on his bike and rode away from his parents' home in Ireland and made his way to London. He arrived with nothing, but once there, everything he touched seemed to turn to gold. In due course, his two brothers, Sean and Tommy, followed him to London, and both thrived on his success. Tommy worked as a joiner and as a foreman on Louis's sites for the whole of Louis's reign in London, whilst Sean eventually took up driving coaches for a well-known coach proprietor before he eventually went on to buy his own coach. The lifestyle in London was a completely new ball game to me. It was a million miles away from the much more mundane and less sophisticated sleepy castle town. Louis drove around in flash cars, wore expensive clothes, wined and dined in London's top restaurants. Joan wore expensive jewellery, and their five kids had every toy in creation. I was given fivers for pocket money. Louis would always make sure his two brothers, Sean and Tommy, were present as he pulled out a fiver and thrust it into my hand, knowing full well that the other two would have to follow suit. Now I was a millionaire too. As a lad of about 12 or 13 with £15 in my pocket in the 1960s, I had joined the jet set. Yes, London meant untold wealth, and for a kid it held many fascinations, but it wasn't Castletown. It was big, busy and dirty, and it wasn't home. For some reason, it always seemed to be Uncle Sean who drove us back from the half-term stint in London. It was always an early start, around 6 a.m, as going back to school had to coincide with Mother and Father first being taken to the pierhead for the 11 a.m. sailing to Douglas. This meant that I would be back in school at about 12 p.m, long before any of the other kids. I didn't really mind this. It was not as if I'd come from home, and I didn't have that horrible, sickly feeling in the pit of my stomach that I used to get when returning to school from home. Uncle Sean had a heart of gold, and his generosity towards me as a child knew no bounds, and he has continued in that vein right up until the present day. Before dropping me back at the school, he would slip me another fiver over and above the one he had given me in London when being shamed by Louis. In truth, I don't believe Louis had ever shamed him into giving me anything. He had a very generous nature and would have given of his own free will anyway. I remember once returning to school after one of these London jaunts with £12 in my pocket. This was as much as Dad earned in the gasworks as a week's wages, and I was probably the richest kid in the school for a short period. I decided not to hand over my loot to the nuns, as I didn't see much point in having so much money and then being restricted to 2 or 3 shillings a week. In any case, I could manage my fortune much better than they could. Hanging on to this fortune was something of a pointless exercise, really, as I couldn't spend it in the school tuck shop, or at the weekend when we were being taken out by the teachers, since my somewhat lavish lifestyle would have been noticed. So I kept it, because it made me feel better, knowing that at least I knew that if the chance ever came my way, I had enough money for my escape boat fare or whatever. Over a period of time, the money was gradually frittered away and was usually well spent before the end of term. In London, Uncle Louis continued to amass his fortune, although I only came into contact with him when he made the occasional visit to the Isle of Man or on those sporadic half-term trips to London. As for Uncle Sean, well, that was a different matter. He had instructed me to phone his home in London once a week, reversing the charges, which I did every Saturday. Whenever his coach journeys brought him north, he would make his way out to the school to visit me, sometimes having to drive 20 or 30 miles out of his way to do so. This also caused me to be the centre of attention, as not only did I turn up at the school with the occasional sea captain and roar off to London in posh cars, but now and then empty coaches would turn up to visit me. I think my status in the school had now changed from someone who came with nothing to someone who had somehow made good and was now something of an executive pupil. Chapter 14. My executive status was further enhanced by a change that was made to my travel arrangements. From now on, I was to fly to and from school at the end of each term. The Isle of Man government would pay for this air travel, and I guess it was cheaper than paying someone to travel over by boat, stay in a hotel, and travel back with me the next day. From now on, I would be taken to the airport by a member of staff from school, put on a plane, and met at the other end by someone from home. The same thing would happen in reverse going back. This would be great for going home, as I would now be home in half an hour, and more importantly, I would be home the same day and not lose a day by having to stay overnight in a Liverpool hotel. However, it was not good from a going back point of view. I would be back at school within an hour of leaving home. Up until now, the boat had provided me with a 4-hour transitional period in which to adjust. My love affair with the Isle of Man steam packet was not at an end. I would still use the boat at half terms, as Mother and Father still had to meet the expense of half-term travel. On my first flight home, I was, however, accompanied by Mother. I don't know why. It must have been deemed by the powers that be that I would be better off accompanied for the first trip. Despite many flights to and from the island, I have never developed a passion for air travel or a fascination with aircraft as I did for the sea. Nonetheless, I do clearly remember my first journey home by air. It was going home day once again, and I remember sitting on the bench in the main corridor outside the school clinic. I was even more excited than normal this time, as I was not going to be spending a night in a Liverpool hotel and losing a precious day of my holiday. The kids were all running up and down the corridor in that usual going-home-day excitement. I remember Mrs. Pope, one of my teachers, walking up to me and saying, "I suppose you'll not be leaving us until tomorrow, Thomas." "No, miss," I replied, "I'm flying home tonight at 5 o'clock." I was not just excited about going home. This time it was because I was travelling by plane as well. I imagined an aeroplane to be something like a bus, but I simply could not sort out in my head just what this bus would be like. None of my brothers had ever flown, and none of my mates had either. In fact, I didn't know anyone who had ever been on an aeroplane, and I was going to be something of a celebrity when I got home. Mother duly arrived, and we set off to Liverpool city centre to do some shopping. Mother didn't have much in the way of money to spend, but I think she enjoyed just looking around the big stores in Liverpool. In the 1960s, the air services to the Isle of Man from Liverpool were operated by Cambrian Airways. They flew from Liverpool to Belfast, stopping off at the Isle of Man en route. As a child, I had visited our local airport at Ronald's Way many times and loved sitting in the departure lounge listening to the announcements, but glad that I was not travelling myself. Nonetheless, I was still excited with the thought of my first plane trip, and my fear of flying was overcome that day by the fact that I was flying home. I would be home the same night. Tonight I would be playing on the beach with Kevin and my mates, and not stuck in some Liverpool hotel. As I sat in my seat of the Cambrian Airways Viscount aircraft, I thought how comfy the seats were. The floor of the aircraft was carpeted, and I remember thinking to myself as I explored the upholstery on the back of the seat in front of me with my fingers that this plane is too nice to crash. It would be such a shame if all these posh seats were soaked by seawater. Yes, everything was going to be just fine. I also recall the announcement made by the stewardess telling us where the life jackets were and how to use them. She went on and on about pulling them over your head and threading the cord around your chest and pulling some sort of toggle. At this point I remember thinking, "Crumbs, Mother will never manage this. Why the hell didn't she send Dad?" Soon after we took off from Liverpool, the stewardess brought drinks around, and I was offered orange juice. I declined this on the grounds that I would not have time to drink it. By some queer logic, known only to an air-frightened child, in refusing the juice, I was telling myself that there was not enough time to drink it, and therefore the flight would be over all the quicker. The Viscount glided down through the Manx evening sky. Soon we touched down at Ronald's Way Airport, and once again I was home. However, this homecoming by air was not the same as an arrival by sea. Stepping onto the tarmac at Ronald's Way was not quite the same as stepping off the gangway and onto the pier at Douglas. There was many an occasion when I could have kissed the ground when stepping onto the King Edward or Victoria pier at Douglas, but I never got such a desire with the tarmac at Ronald's Way. Nevertheless, I was home after a short 30-minute flight, and I had not lost a day's holiday by having to stay overnight in Liverpool. Of course, I had heard the noise of aircraft passing over our house, which was only half a mile from the airport, and I had often wondered what it must be like to be in one. Well, now I knew. I could now tell my brothers and my mates what planes were like, and then get back to boats. Chapter 15. The summer holiday of 1967 was a bit special. I was 13 years old, and in September I would be 14. This meant that when I went back to school I would be eligible for my permission. At St. Vincent's, permission, which was granted to kids as soon as they reached the age of 14, meant that you could go out on your own, unaccompanied by a member of school staff. It only applied at weekends, but it did mean that as soon as I returned, I would be able to roam Liverpool freely. I could go wherever I pleased, and although it would still be a wrench to leave Castletown in September, at least this time I would have something to look forward to. But for now, there was a whole 7-week summer holiday to enjoy, and every single day of it was going to be like Christmas Day. Just as change was on its way at St. Vincent's in Liverpool, so too were things changing in Castletown. I was no longer confined to the Castletown area for my leisure activities. From now on, I would be allowed to venture to such places as Douglas and Port Erin on the bus with my younger brother Kevin. The whole gang, which included Billy Ronan, the son of the captain I referred to earlier, and the two brothers Michael and Brian Christian, who lived just across the road from us, would usually set off on these adventures. I could never tire of such places as Langness, with its acres of open space for me to roam over freely, or Castletown Beach, which I often had entirely to myself, to run on the sand or to scramble over the slippery rocks, or Castletown itself, with its quiet narrow streets, where a blind child could wander through the nooks and crannies in more or less perfect safety. Notwithstanding all these things, the trips to Douglas were exciting, special treats, and they are as fresh in my mind today as if they had just happened yesterday. With a few shillings in our pockets, Brother Kev, Billy, Brian, Michael and myself would head off for Douglas. I always got a buzz from the bus ride alone on our trips to Douglas. There was that feel-good feeling knowing I was not going for the 9 o'clock boat. Stepping off the bus in Douglas bus station, I would get a tingle in my bones, the special kind of excitement that you can only find in a busy holiday resort in the middle of summer. I loved the noise that came from the busy shop doorways as we scurried past on our march through Strand Street. There was the smell of burgers, hot dogs and chips wafting through the air, and the latest chart sounds of the Beatles and Cliff Richard coming from the record shops. Throngs of people were everywhere. Sometimes I would hear the most wonderful sound, the shrill of the steam whistle from one of the steam packet vessels about to depart, even more wonderfully, without me on board. We would go on to the promenade for the 3-mile walk along its entire length until we reached our destination, the White City Fairground. We would take the seaward side of the prom. As we walked, I could hear the clip-clop of the horse trams on my left-hand side, whilst on my right there was the sound of the sea as it gently washed the Douglas shoreline. Thousands of delighted shrieks of enjoyment would drift up from the water's edge. Douglas was full of happy holiday-makers, and the feel of the hot summer sun on my face, along with the shrieks of joy coming up from the beach, together with the rattle of the horse trams trundling along the prom, made me feel good to be alive. Eventually we would reach the White City Fairground. As soon as we entered this magical place of fun, I would be totally transfixed by the atmosphere of the place. There was the siren of the ghost train screaming out above everything else, the sound of the Dodgem cars as they smashed into one another, and the distant pop, pop, pop of the motorboats as they cruised their way around the boating lake. The air was full of the sound of happy people, and you didn't need to be wealthy to feel that you were the happiest kid on the planet. Kevin, Billy, Michael and Brian would have a go on every stall, be it throwing hoops at targets or knocking bottles over with small balls. At the end of it, they would count up all their prizes and share them with me. Even though I had not won any of them, I would usually end up with more prizes than they had. The same rules applied on the fairground as applied on the mushroom fields or when we were collecting golf balls. They shared everything they had with me. The gang was totally as one. No wonder I didn't want to go away to school. I didn't have any brothers over there, and I would not find mates like these lads anywhere else in the world. Although I was now going to places such as Douglas, all the other activities did not get neglected. There was still the odd shift at the gas works to put in, and my visits to the coal boats took precedence over anything else. My neighbour and close friend Michael Quinn had now taken up work with the steam packet, and this would prove to be very beneficial to me when I returned to school in September. In the meantime, I would often take a trip with him in his small 13-foot wooden boat which he kept berthed in Castletown Harbour. There was not an awful lot of activity on a Sunday on the Isle of Man in those days. I recall one Sunday afternoon when Dad decided to join us for a quick trip around the bay. Dad was not a sailor, and so it was a rare thing for him to join us on such jaunts. However, I remember him on this occasion commenting to Michael about the racket the boat's outboard engine was making as we motored out of Castletown Harbour. He was concerned that someone might complain about the noise we were making on a Sunday. How attitudes change. Now a bomb could go off in the middle of the town square and hardly anyone would blink. Other things were now starting to interest me, including photography. This might seem strange, but for some reason I developed a fascination with the camera. I remember the weekend when my two rich uncles, Louis and Sean, came from London to stay with us. Needless to say, I ended up with more pocket money than I was accustomed to. With money in my pocket, I took myself off to Peggy Watterson's toy shop and bought myself a smart little camera for 4 shillings and 6p. I don't recall Peggy asking me why I wanted the camera, or the local chemist asking me why I wanted a film. Anyway, off I went, taking photographs all over town. I took snaps of coal boats, the river, the steam trains, and friends. Later, when I got my film back from the chemist, having had it developed, I was not at all dismayed that none of my photos had come out. After all, what did my friends know anyway? The photos may not have come out as far as they were concerned, but I could find absolutely nothing wrong with them. They were about 6 inches long and 4 inches wide. They were smooth on one side and glossy on the other, and of course they were photographs. They felt just like any other photographs, and as far as I was concerned, they were just as good as anyone else's. Rich uncles from London were not the only way of raising much-needed funds in those days, and our gang was not short of enterprise. Bottles provided a very handy source of income. The problem was finding enough of them. For every bottle we handed over the shop counter, we would receive threepence, so with this in mind, bottle thieving was big business. A considerable bounty was to be had through the local pub, the Duck's Nest. This pub kept all its empty bottles in crates around the back of the building, and I, accompanied by my brother Kevin and Brian and Michael, would sneak around the back and carefully select the pop bottles. We only took pop bottles, as we knew we would get no joy from the landlord if we knocked on the pub door and tried to pass him beer bottles. Of course, it didn't take the landlord long to work out that bottles he had previously paid out on and placed in crates behind the pub were coming back to him for a second payout, and we were sent packing. The trick then was to take bottles from one pub or shop and offer them to another. It came as no surprise to me when the cash back for bottles scheme ground to a halt. In that September of 1967, my brother Lenny only had one term left before leaving school. He got a job straight away working for Downwoods, the lemonade factory in Douglas. What a shame they'd done away with the cash back for bottles system by then. We would have been tax exiles with the money we would have made as he brought home almost as much pop as the factory produced. The tin can has much to answer for. Not only did it do away with our small bottles, but it is also non-returnable. Of course, there were still the lost golf balls to be rounded up from the Langness golf course and sold on. Then Billy, who I guess was the gang's chief executive, had also worked out how, by the use of a knife, pennies could be retrieved from the door of the public toilet. This means of funding never really amounted to very much. The coin-collecting mechanism in the door often proved somewhat reluctant to give up its contents, and this, together with the noise the knife made extracting what was never more than a small amount of cash, meant that it was eventually given up as a high-risk, low-paying enterprise. We realised that we needed a more regular income, and both Billy and Kevin did paper rounds for the two newsagents in Castletown. For this, they received about 12 shillings and 6p a week, and of course I accompanied one or other of them, and sometimes both, carrying the paper bag on my shoulder for the duration of the round. They shared their wages with me, and I guess I was doing my bit, but in truth they would both have been able to complete their task much quicker on their bikes. Still, At least in September, when it was time for me to return to school, their wages would shoot up and they would get the work done a little faster. Well, money isn't everything, and it certainly wasn't then, for they both shed just as many tears as I did when the time came for me to return to Liverpool. The school summer holiday passed all too quickly. Having spent the last couple of months fishing off piers, swimming in the sea, rambling on Langness and sailing with Michael in his small boat, not to mention putting in the odd shift at the gasworks, and the hours and hours just sitting on the quayside at Castletown, absorbing the goings-on at the harbour, it was little wonder that going back to school was a depressing thought. The difference this time to my returning to St. Vincent's would be that I would be going by air and unaccompanied. I would simply be taken to the airport, put on the plane, and met in Liverpool by one of the teachers.